If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's a rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Now here's your host, Ed Mate.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Spirit of the Game. It is now November. We only have a few more days to post scores. So what could be more fitting than to bring in our resident expert on handicapping and course rating, our very own Aaron Gorecka. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Welcome to the pod, man.
Man, it is nice to be here.
Couple East High grads just chewing the fat. How about
yes,
that?
Something like
Evan
that.
Scholars. We got a lot in common. Correct. Charm, good looks. What
at
else?
Least,
good three-pointers.
Good three-pointers. Yeah. The love of CU football.
Yes.
Regardless of how they're playing.
Yeah, that's right. Always loyal to those Buffs.
Yes.
Yeah. No, this is fun. We're going to do at least three parts on this. Maybe 10. I don't know. Well, we're going to start at the beginning. So, Aaron, introduce yourself, including your title, for those who don't know who you are, the man behind behind course rating and handicapping.
Well, the man, I like to refer to myself as the man that helps things run, that lives in the background. You know,
okay.
People need me, but don't know that I do it. But
if
anyway,
you work in this office, you're not in the background. You're not an introvert. So.
Correct. And those that work with me know that I am the everybody knows when I arrive and everybody knows when I leave. So, good morning, afternoon, evening, everybody. My name is Aaron Gorecka, and my official title here is the Managing Director of Club and Facility Services. What does that mean? I like to say I do a little bit of everything. My main duties are course rating and handicapping and helping with everything that falls under those umbrellas. But I also do a little bit of, those that use the tournament management software, UTM, formerly known as Golf Genius. I do that still sometimes.
Wait a minute. It's not Golf Genius anymore?
No, it's I forget what UTM is, but it's something tournament management.
That's, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
It's powered by Golf Genius.
I already learned something.
Correct.
Yep.
I do a little bit of Google support sometimes, you know, a little bit of email support. So I do everything under the sun, and whatever's asked of me, I try to do.
So even, I think your story is pretty cool too. You were a first tee kid.
Correct.
You grew up over on the, I guess, on the west side of Denver.
North side.
Of Denver. Or northwest sort of. Yeah, north side. But you went to East, but correct, you were an Evan Scholar. So how did you get into golf?
Well, when I was 5 years old, my mom said I needed to not watch cartoons all day and, you know, go do something. And so she signed me up for golf. And my grandpa actually was the one who took me to the classes. And we would go to golf class and then go to Village Inn every week.
So this was first tee, though.
This was first tee. This was Denver Junior Golf.
Okay, even before first tee. Man, you're old.
But eventually Denver Junior Golf turned into what we now know as the first tee of Colorado Rocky Mountains or something like that.
Yeah,
yeah. So I'm one of the originals, to say the least.
OGs. And then you ended up getting an Evan Scholarship, and
I was a different kind of caddy. I was more of an entrepreneurial caddy, if you will. I didn't have a
freelance.
Correct.
Yeah.
I didn't have a your typical caddy master. Uh-huh. I'd be at the course 6 a.m. every day, ask people if they would like a caddy for free, because I just wanted a free college education versus, you know, the money at the time. Although everybody who I caddied for usually gave me a little something, which was great, but no, I definitely wasn't searching for that at the time. Yeah. It was nice, but I eventually built up a clientele who knew what I was trying to do. And so whenever they would play, they actually would call me and I would meet them, whatever course they'd be at. So.
Well, and you got the ultimate tip. An Evans Scholarship, a full education and housing grant to the University of Colorado. Not bad.
Correct.
I can say that because I was like you, proud Evans Scholar alum. All right. Great to introduce yourself. So let's talk about course rating. Now, why do we care? What's the purpose of course rating? Why do we rate golf courses?
Well, for one, rating a golf course essentially gives us a way to be able to take those numbers and be able to travel with what people know today as the handicap index. And so without a course rating, you will not be able to establish a handicap index, therefore unable to travel with that and be able to play equitably against other people, your friends, family, competitors, whatever.
And again, we can go a step further. Why do we have a handicap to begin with is to compete equitably.
Correct.
It's all about competition.
Correct.
The Colorado Golf Association would not exist if it wasn't for competition. If people just went out for fun, there would be no Colorado Golf Association. You and I would be unemployed, or we'd be working bagging groceries. I don't know what we'd be doing.
Correct.
We'd be singing for our supper for sure. So it really is kind of the birth of the CGA in 1901. So let's go back in history a little bit. So how did course rating get started? And what does give us kind of a feel of, you don't have to go deep, but just give us the high points on the history.
Yeah. So it's funny you asked that. So I did not know much of this because I'm not the biggest of historical individuals, but I went back and did a little bit of digging. And if we go all the way back to 1870.
And by the way, this information you found is in the course rating manual.
Correct. In the USGA course rating manual that is given to every course rater who is willing to do the job.
Okay.
But anyway, if we go back to 1870, 1870 is when the first measure of course difficulty, also known as par, was created. And par essentially at that time meant playing the perfect score for the golf course, which was crazy. So now if we go 20 years later in the year 1890, Coventry Golf Club allocated a scratch value for each hole, which they termed as then known as the ground score. Yeah, interesting, right? And so then in May 1891, Mr. Hugh Rotherham conceived the concept of each player playing a match against that ground score on each hole. And then Dr. Thomas Brown of Great Yarmouth later referred to that imaginary opponent as, wait for it, the regular bogey man.
Yes.
Not easily caught, or terming or creating the term bogey.
Right.
The bogey,
which was kind of the first, wasn't bogey a precursor to par? Wasn't that kind of the standard that was expected, or was that kind of the standard?
So par was the standard.
I see.
Bogey was playing the standard.
I see.
Correct.
Okay.
Because remember, according to, you know, those 2 years, the standard was playing perfect golf.
I see.
And then playing against that perfect golf was the bogey golf.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. And then in 1893, the Ladies Golf Union was formed by Honorary Secretary Miss Isette Pearson.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is because what the LGU did was they were able to create a handicap system, if you will, that was reasonably reliable from club to club using some of this information. Now, if we go to the 1900s, 1905 specifically.
So the birthplace of handicapping was, of course, it was on the other side of the pond,
correct,
like all things golf.
Correct.
Very fitting. Yeah.
Correct.
They were okay.
So now if we go to 1905, Mr. Layton Calkins, who became the chairman of the Metropolitan Golf Association. I'm going to drop some golf associations here because it was a collective doing all of this work together. But they authored the pamphlet, A System for Club Handicapping.
Okay.
Par was the basis of the system. And then again, it was defined as the perfect play without flukes under normal weather conditions, which those of you who are course raters that are listening know that normal weather conditions is how we rate a golf course, in theory, anyway, allowing for two putts on each green.
Okay.
So that's what par was.
Okay.
Okay. Now move to 1911. The USGA adopted its first course rating system, in which course ratings were based on the play of U.S. amateur champion Jerome Travers.
Okay.
So determining course ratings based on the expected score of the national amateur champion became accepted, and course rating in the USA was born.
Okay.
So I found that.
You know, it's interesting there, just to pause on that for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the back in the day, handicaps were all sort of wheeling off of the best player in the club.
Correct.
So everything was localized against, okay, who's our benchmark player? We're Jerome Travers or, you know, whoever it may be at that club. So everybody's handicap was relative to one individual, the wheel off.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So that's, it's kind of where a couple of things were born, unintentionally or intentionally.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe more to go come there. But anyway, so in 1960, there was a couple of things that happened between 1911 and 1960, but we won't go into
those. We'll keep this to one part instead of 10.
Correct. I'm just hitting the highlights.
Today. Yeah.
So then a single approach was introduced that involved the preliminary yardage rating for each hole. So now we have the introduction of what we know today as a yardage or a length rating.
Okay.
And then this will then be modified by additional obstacles.
Okay.
Okay. So that was, again, 1960.
Okay. The year Palmer won the Open. Pretty notable year.
Correct.
At Cherry Hills, right?
Very notable, especially here in Colorado.
Yeah.
So then in 1968, all of this information has been kind of building, been worked on by multiple professors and different types of individuals within golf and outside of golf. The USGA released its first truly uniform handicap system for both men and women.
Okay.
Also, each hole was assigned a yardage rating, the total of which was then expressed in decimal fractions of a stroke. So instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, each hole essentially got a yardage rating, which was compiled together to create a course rating.
Okay.
Okay. All right. And then that rating would then be adjusted if truly exceptional, which we know differently now. Features were present on the golf hole, such as water, tall grass, short grass, quick green, things like that.
So that was what year?
In 1968, what we now know as obstacles were introduced.
Okay. It's amazing that it took quite a bit longer for the slope system to really land.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, it's not too long ago where this was actually created.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So then in 1977, I want everybody to hear this name, Lieutenant Commander Dean Knuth.
Yeah, the
Pope of Slope, as some of you may know, of the Naval Postgraduate School proposed a course rating system which involved the numerical rating of 10 characteristics of each hole, which, for those of you listening, we still use today. Mm-hmm. They've been adjusted over time, but we still use 10 characteristics or obstacles. And now going to 1981, the concepts of expert, which we now know as scratch, and bogey ratings were incorporated into the course rating system. And this is important because we don't rate for slope when we rate a golf course. We rate for two golfers, the scratch player, or in 1981, also known as the expert player, and the bogey player. And the mathematical difference between the two gives you your slope.
Correct.
Which a lot of people think we measure slope, but we actually don't. It's just a mathematical equation.
Rise over run. I'm showing off.
Exactly. Yeah. Rise over run.
Yeah.
And for those of you who didn't know, we use math here. We definitely use lots of math.
That's why I'm not involved.
correct. I didn't know it at the time, but
good. Fortunately for us, you're good at math.
Correct. Math was my forte in school. And then also in 1982 and 1983, or should I say, let's start in 1982, verbatim, the Colorado Golf Association was the first association to rate all of its courses using the new course rating procedure. And then following that up in 1983, the Colorado Golf Association tested the slope system with positive results. And then the following year,
you got to mention Dr. Byron Williamson, who is a member of the handicap research team. And we named our match play trophy after Dr. Williamson. A lot of people have no idea who he was. He was on the board of the CGA, and he was credited for really leading that charge to be the first state in the country to rate all of our golf courses in accordance to the new system. So pretty cool.
Correct.
That the CGA was really at the forefront of this.
Correct. And fun fact too, we still have a couple of those ratings on some rice paper in a couple of the old courses.
That should go into the Hall of Fame down at the Broadmoor. I love it.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting, because then in 1983, five additional AGAs decided to rate courses based on our module, if you will. And then other people just followed suit, where eventually all 50 states, now not only in the USA, but worldwide, have a rating, or in theory. And then last but not least, the most recent change, it's fairly small, but I just wanted to mention it to kind of bring us home here up to where we are today. It was in 2024. So now courses of the length of 750 yards or longer can now be rated for both men and women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, pretty amazing journey for sure. And it all starts with, hey, let's compete. Let's play. Let's create a level as best we can, a level playing field between varying abilities of golfers. And that's one of the many things that makes golf such a great game. It's a game of a lifetime. And it's amazing to me how good the handicap system is. I know it's not perfect, and but it's pretty darn good. And I know it's getting better all the time. When we look at, you know, the way, I'm sure AI will play a role in this, and the future is, you know, who knows. So let's now get into the how a golf course is rated. So we know it's kind of a how it started, why it started. How does this work? It's funny because I'll introduce this and then throw it to you. When we get a new volunteer and they hear about the CGA and they think, how could I get involved? One of the committees that you are intimately involved with and support is our course rating committee. And a lot of golfers hear course rating and they think it's like going to be a food critic. I get to eat the meal and decide if it was good or not. Not quite. I always warn people, I say, course rating is not for everyone. And the people who are attracted to course rating are not the Ed Mates. They're the Aaron Gorecos who are good at math, because it's a very technical, to me, it's mind numbing work. It's really hard. And I don't have the patience. Frankly, I just don't have the aptitude for it. So take us through how the Colorado Golf Association and our peer group around the country, how does a golf course get its rating?
Well, a couple ways. So for anybody who wants to be a course rater listening today, possibly, we put you through a fairly aggressive course rating training session. Well, one, we try to scare tactic you. We give you a 3-hour training, tell you everything that we do, and we give you a month to let us know if you want to move forward and be one of the crazy people and join the committee here, or if you just want to wash your hands of this, forget you even went through the training and just play golf versus rating.
That would be
course.
Me.
Yes. But anyway, so rating a course is a thorough process, because we go from organizing it to actually boots on the ground to then analyzing data. But the main kind of, or the main thing you need in order to have an accurate course rating is an accurate course measurement. So before we rate any golf course, we see if the course has been measured and how recent that measurement was. And we also ask the course if there's been any additions to the golf course, whether that be tees, did you lengthen out a hole? Did you change the design of a hole? Things like that. And if that's the case, we take our measuring device, which our current one is now accurate to within 2 centimeters for each latitude and longitude point, which is pretty darn good, I would say. And then, so we measure the golf course based off of the USGA requirements.
Is that a one-person job, a two-person job? How does that actually
happen? It could be a one-person job, but it's a two-person job because you need a driver.
Yeah,
it goes a whole lot quicker when you have a driver, particularly in the mountains. If you don't have a driver, you're sweating, or you're constantly in and out of the cart. Because for us, we measure every single tee box, every single turning point, and every front and back of green through all 18 holes. And we give a clubhouse point to kind of give us a, you know, orientation point.
To date myself, I started working for the CGA in 1985 as an intern, and Red Nelson and Chuck Shore were the measuring committee, a committee of two. Yeah. And they were former engineers, I'm pretty sure. Both members, I think Chuck was at Pinehurst and Red was at Rolling Hills. And they would set up the tripods, and they would shoot the angles and did it all very old fashioned. And that was that rice paper you were referring to that ended up, but it all started with the accurate measurements, and that hasn't changed. It's certainly technology's advanced, so it's a lot more accurate.
Correct.
And
and we actually use a device that engineering teams use to build highways.
Wow.
So same Trimble device. We just don't pay for the highest of accuracy.
So when we measure a golf course, do we remeasure it every single time it's re-rated, or do we trust the previous measurements going in? So I may be jumping ahead a little bit too far, because there's not a whole lot of new golf opening up.
Correct.
When, during the 1990s and early 2000s, there was 6, 7, 8 courses opening every year. So there was a lot of work to be done to measure all those new golf courses. Mm-hmm. And so how does that happen? Because again, the measurement is fundamental.
Correct.
How do you update?
Yeah. Those? So essentially what we do, because every course has been measured.
Yeah.
Now what we're looking for is what is the accuracy of the measurement? Mm-hmm. And so essentially what we do is we determine when the course was measured. Cause some courses, they just don't have the money to, you know, build new tees or mm-hmm. adjust too many things on the golf course. So we're fairly accurate with those measurements, especially if it's been measured with one of the most recent devices that we've had. Mm-hmm. If it was pre those devices, we make sure that we get it remeasured with a GPS device mm-hmm. That we have now.
So when you show up to rate the golf course and you said boots on the ground,
correct.
That has to have been done in advance. Otherwise you'd be wasting
correct. Otherwise
time, right?
otherwise we're going in blind, if you will. Yeah. We try not to use the scorecard because according to the course rating, or to the course rating guidebook, scorecard is one way, but you know, in order to keep things consistent, every golf course should have been measured by the same standard in order to get the same results for every golf course. So if the golf course hasn't been measured, then technically we're kind of flying blind, if you will. Mm-hmm. So we use the scorecard at that point, but then we go back and measure it just to see how close it was and then, you know, make the adjustments from there.
So
it's not the end of the world if that happens, yeah. But we definitely do need to get GPS.
The other thing that is really amazing to me, because again, being involved for a long time, the chair of our course rating committee for many, many years was a guy named John Dukes. And John would work with a very small committee. And it seemed like four individuals would, and again, the Colorado Women's Golf Association was doing this separately because they mm-hmm. were separate associations prior to 2018. But it was a very small team. And I can't imagine how they did it, but maybe the system was a little easier to navigate. But now how many people typically arrive when you rate a golf course day of?
Well, good segue there on measuring. Now we're measuring people.
Yeah.
So it all depends on the amount of tees that the golf course has.
Okay.
So we try to have one person per tee per gender.
Okay.
So those of you out there who are new to course rating, we rate for both men and women, scratch and bogey golfers. And so part of the training process is for any course rater to be able to rate for either a man or a woman from any tee set, regardless of length.
Okay.
So that is like bare minimum of being a course rater, or for us to even.
So what is that? What is that math? Is that 16 so, people? Is it 10 people? Is it 12 people?
So if you have 4 ratings for men and 3 for women, it would be 8 people for rating for men and then 6 people rating for women. So 14 people.
Yeah. So it's a team.
Correct. It's pretty hefty, and yeah. we're one of the lucky associations because we have quite a healthy committee with lots of people who are willing to travel, things like that.
Right.
Some other associations aren't as lucky. So, you know, they have teams of 6 yeah. or 8 having to do multiple tee sets, which to be honest with you, would drive me crazy having to do that every single time for 30 times a year. It's just a lot of work.
So you're really only focusing then on 9 holes, right?
Correct.
You're not
correct.
Having to do the entire 18.
Correct.
So how long, and we'll go into the details of the obstacles and the process. And mm-hmm. is it still called a Form 1 or is that?
Yes, okay. Still called a Form 1.
I know a very, not even enough to be dangerous, but
yes.
So how long does that take?
So typically it takes 3 to 4 hours.
Okay.
Depending on the difficulty of the golf course. You have a very flat golf course with very little obstacles. We could get it done in 3, maybe even 2.5 hours.
Okay.
If you have a golf course, say like one of the mountain courses, that's very, that has a lot of altitude changes, lots of obstacles, a lot of trees, blind shots, things like that. Those tend to take a little bit longer.
Okay. So now let's dive in. Let's take for instance, which golf course should we pick on? What's the most recent course you rated?
The most recent one?
It's probably in Wyoming.
No, the most recent mountain course we did was Pole Creek. The most recent one in town was Columbine Country Club.
Okay, so let's do Columbine. And by the way, just to work this in there, the CGA is responsible for rating all the golf courses in Wyoming as well.
Correct.
So you have become quite familiar with the other rectangular state.
Yes, it took me a couple of years, but now I now speak Wyoming. So
you do. You know,
that's good. I'm able to get around quite
That's pretty
quite
good.
Well out there.
Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Yes. We don't want to offend anybody on either side of the border. All right. So you arrive at Columbine. This is like, when was this? A couple weeks ago. You don't rate. When do you shut down course rating?
And we try not to go further than middle of September. Okay.
Because you want the playing conditions to be season.
Correct. Yeah. We try to get to as close to mid-season conditions as possible. Once leaves start falling and, you know, watering and things start to change, then golf courses are no longer in technically mid-season condition.
Right. So how many folks did you have for the Columbine rate, roughly?
I think we had about 14 people
okay.
for the Columbine rate.
Okay. So I've shown up. I'm at Columbine. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take the front nine, right? I'm part of the front nine team.
So what happens is we actually assign captains to every rate.
Okay.
So there's essentially a leader for every team that determines who the team's going to be.
Okay.
Does all the calling.
Like the captain for the entire rate, not correct. Just one captain, not correct. Like a captain for each tee.
Correct. So there's a captain for the entire rate that assigns a person to each tee box.
Okay.
So when you arrive, you will know what tee you'll be rating, whether it's men or women. Although we have now gotten into the habit of sending out our tee assignments prior to the rate.
Right.
So people can do a lot of homework. We've gotten really good with using Google Earth. So any dogleg cuts we're actually able to do ahead of time and then make adjustments if we need to, depending on the situation. Like if the trees that we couldn't see on Google Earth are bigger and we can't make a cut for some reason, then we adjust.
Got it.
But our
you answered my next question was how much of that work can I do in advance?
Correct. So we can do quite a bit of work, although you still need boots on the ground just to ensure the accuracy of that work. Mm-hmm. Because Google Earth only gives you so much.
Right.
So we still need to boots on the ground to measure those.
We have a bunch of numbers, the overall length of a hole. What other numbers do you really need to put together a rating? What other, I'm sure they're countless, but what are those
So
walk us through some of those numbers.
So like you said, you alluded to it. We have a yardage mm-hmm. for every hole, for every tee box, which is preferably done by us prior to the rate, just mm-hmm. to give us accurate values. And then one of the requirements that we ask of the golf course prior to us arriving on course that day is to set the tees where you want them to be rated. Mm-hmm. In accordance with the measuring devices. So we can make adjustments prior to going instead of showing up and tees being moved forward or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we try to get the tees to where, or try to have the course set the tees where they're going to be for the majority of play.
And by the, on that, how much wiggle room does a course have from the, we'll call it the center point? Cause it's always interesting. You know, I've been curious. A lot of times course operators cheat the tees up, particularly at public golf courses.
Correct.
Privates, I think, are a little bit more pure when it comes to maintaining the integrity of the rating. But for pace of play reasons, we all know it's so typical to see the back tee has been cheated up to the second correct. Back and on. But what is the allowance of how far forward or how far back is it still a valid?
See what I'm asking? Yeah. So, a course rating maintains its integrity for about 20 yards forward or back.
Okay.
So when we rate a course, we rate from the middle of the tee box.
I see.
Therefore, allowing for the tee markers to move forward a little bit, backward a little bit.
Okay.
Maybe even moving a forward tee box. That's not our preference, is to move a whole tee box. If it's going to be there the most of the time, we want to rate from there. But there is some wiggle room.
Okay. So we started with the overall yardage.
Correct.
From each tee to the middle of the green?
To the turning point.
Oh, okay.
The natural turning point to the middle of the green.
Okay.
Yeah.
So par threes don't have a turning point.
No, par threes do not have
a turning point. That would be a pretty interesting par three if it did.
Correct.
So every hole has a turning point?
Not every hole.
Okay. I think about the third hole at Common Ground. Just think of Columbine. Absolutely has a turning point on hole one. I can pretty much play as a turning point on every hole. And I think about it.
Turning point on 11. That's the biggest one.
Yeah.
And so what we do when we do get our measurements is we actually confirm everything with Google Earth. We have the ability to overlay our measurements over a Google Earth view of everything. And so if we need to make adjustments, we can, just to kind of give us the most accurate data.
Okay.
There.
So I want to not lose my way. We're going to talk numbers.
Correct.
Turning points are really interesting to me because they can be interpreted differently.
Correct.
And I know that over the years, we've sometimes come up with different total yardages because of a different interpretation of where the turning point is. And one hole that I know, I remember Jim Ang arguing about the 14th hole at Redlands Mesa, which is a kind of theoretically a drivable par four, but it really isn't. And he was arguing that the turn point was much further down than where we were measuring it. And that, as a result, changed the overall length.
Correct.
Because when you, so speak to that.
Yeah. So the turning point, we try to gather a natural turning point. And based on the definition of what a turning point is, it has to be kind of the average turning point for all tee sets. Because in theory, or in reality, every tee set, depending on which one you play, could have a different turning point.
Yeah.
But in order, like I said, to maintain consistency, which is what course rating is the name of the game there, you have to establish an average turning point for all tee sets, not just for the back tee or the forward tee, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the hardest part of measuring, is defining what that turning point is.
And how much is it usually pretty easy to identify?
Pretty easy.
Yeah.
Pretty easy. The ones are the ones that have a gentle turn.
Yeah.
Or the par fours, you know, you have your boomerang par four.
Yeah.
Where you could potentially have two turning points.
Yeah. Sanctuary has a couple of those.
Correct.
Yeah.
There's a couple of courses that have a couple of
Jim Ang, man. He makes our jobs hard, that dude.
Oh, I'll tell you what,
I'm sure Jim is listening, so that's what I wanted to
say. Jim Ang puts us to the test. So we like rating those courses. We just don't like analyzing the data.
Yeah. Okay. So what other numbers? I mean, to move us along here,
because
I can get bogged down at any point, because I am curious. Correct. I would say I was blessed with large curiosity and cursed with a small brain. Not a good combination. Yeah. Lots of questions, don't understand the answers.
Well, see, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, there you go.
Illuminate.
Exactly. So there's the other thing I've just learned about rating is fairway widths are measured. And elevation changes are measured.
Correct.
And roll and all these other things that roll up into the effective playing length of a hole.
Correct.
So maybe you can talk about what that term is. So is that the right term, effective?
That is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you have the measured length, and then you have the effective playing length, or based on the topography, all the different things that went into the design of the hole, how long does the tee set play? Because it could be measured one length and play a totally different length.
Straight downhill.
Correct.
Straight uphill.
Correct.
Obviously, all of the golf courses in Colorado, there's an altitude adjustment.
Oh, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Every course in Colorado has an altitude adjustment. And what does that mean, essentially, without getting too far into the weeds, is for every 500 feet, there's an adjustment to how far the scratch and bogey golfers can hit.
And is that just men?
Men and women, except for the bogey lady.
Okay.
And the reason why is because studies have shown, or the USGA studies have shown, that bogey lady just can't quite generate the amount of club head speed to make those adjustments at altitude.
To need it.
Correct. Correct. Some do, but on average,
Yeah.
So there's no adjustment for altitude for bogey lady, but for male and female scratch and the male bogey, there's an adjustment for altitude. And so just as you would anticipate, the higher the altitude, the further your golfers can hit.
So let's stay with course rating.
Okay.
So you have the effective playing length.
Yeah.
And I was once told that, pick a number, 96% of a course's rating is derived from the effective playing length. And the influence of obstacle difficulty is a fairly small piece of that puzzle. Is that accurate? Or
that is correct. I would adjust that just a little bit to where I would say the effective playing length is about 90% of a course rate.
Okay.
And then the remaining 10% is the obstacle values.
Okay.
And so that would be our next number, is the effective playing length, and how, and what does that mean, or what obstacles are those? So altitude is one, roll, dog leg or forced layups, dog legs and forced layups.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes our effective playing lengths.
Right. Because if you have a 90 degree dog leg, and you know, it's theoretically a golfer could cut the corner, but they're not going to do that. Then that's effectively a longer hole because it's taking driver out of the hand.
Correct. Yeah. And one thing that we have gotten really good at doing with the use of technology nowadays is getting more accurate yardage as to how much can a golfer actually cut a hole on a dog leg, or how much does a golfer need to be laid up by forcibly or by choice on a hole based on, you know, different measuring techniques that we use.
Right.
So we're able to, with a very high accuracy, determine how far somebody needs to lay up, how far a golfer can cut a dog leg, much, much more accurate than we were, say, maybe 10, 15 yards or 10, 15 years ago.
Which brings us, and we're going to get to the 10 obstacles here in a minute, which is how we're going to, then that will bring in the slope and bogey and all that good stuff, the bogey rating, et cetera. How do we know, tell us about the scratch player. I'm using air quotes because we're not on camera. What does that mean? Because I hear this a lot. They're like, you know, that guy, golfers today can hit it 360 and you're only assuming they hit it 280 or whatever it may be. And that's not accurate.
Correct.
So explain what the term scratch player means and how that's determined.
Well, the first determination I want to make is there's a difference between an elite player and a scratch player. Okay. An elite player is who we see on Sundays. Your scratch players are your golfers that have a zero handicap. And remember, golfers of all ages can have a zero handicap. So just because some golfers can hit it 380 doesn't necessarily mean that they're a scratch golfer. It just means they can hit the ball further. Mm-hmm. But their short game isn't the best.
Right.
But then you have your older individual who only hits the ball 180, 200 yards straight down the middle on in regulation and two putts. Mm-hmm. So scratch golfers comes in all different shapes, sizes, and colors. So that's one difference, but the USGA definition is a person with a 0.0 handicap index is what it.
So I'm learning as we're talking here. I just assumed that there was certain sort of characteristics of a scratch player that were standard. They can hit it this far. Is that correct? And they carry it this far.
Correct. So that would lead us to the next thing is, even though that definition is a zero, for course rating purposes, our scratch golfer, based on the altitude of the golf course, has a standard of length that they can hit. Mm-hmm. So for instance, here in Denver, we're at about, you know, mile high. So our scratch male golfer can hit it about 268 yards.
Okay.
Well, that's correct.
Is that carry distance?
So our carry distance is 248 yards with an assumed 20 yards of roll, equating to 268 yards total.
I got it. So again, the elite player, the guy who's that's not a scratch player.
Right.
Well, wait a minute here. Scratch players come in all sides, shapes and sizes. But for our purposes, that's the key distance.
Correct.
So when you look at a hole through the lens of the scratch player, that's really what you're looking for.
Correct. And then you got to remember too that we use that golfer here, but then in different states we all use the same table to determine how far our scratch golfers can hit.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And what about the scratch female golfer?
I believe here a scratch female golfer hits it about 224. So that means 204 yards in the air with 20 yards of roll, equating to 224.
And what about the bogey male and the bogey female?
Bogey male hits it about 215 yards. So 195 yards in the air, 20 yards of roll. And then the bogey female on her drive hits it 130 yards in the air with 20 yards of roll, equating to 150 yards.
And just to be clear, those golfers are not just made up. I mean, it's based on data.
Correct.
It's based on research.
As you can see, that's based off of going all the way back to, you know, the beginning years of course rating and developing the math and all the numbers equating to what we see.
Well, and
today.
What's interesting, you mentioned Walter Travers, I think.
Yes.
Even to this day, the USGA gathers information from the US Amateur, at least they used to. I don't know if they're still doing that, to kind of benchmark some of the data that they use as underpinnings for course rating. Mm-hmm. At least I don't know if they're still doing that.
The more data, the better for the USGA.
Yeah.
There's so many things that you can look at.
Yeah.
Length is definitely one.
Yeah.
You know, I won't go into that because that's being debated everywhere.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see how an adjustment to length, if there is one, how that will affect course rating.
Okay. So now let's get into the obstacles. And as a first D kid, you remember the 9 core values. I'm sure you can spout them off.
Not as good as I should.
You live by them. They're just intuitive now. They're just baked into you. I got to tell a funny quick aside. Joe Barrow, who is, I believe, the first executive director CEO of the First Tee, came and spoke at a CGA annual meeting one year. And his good friend, Buddy Knoll, asked him, put him on the spot right in front of the entire crowd, what are the 9 core values? And the CEO stumbled and bumbled and said, get back to me on that one. Okay. So what are these obstacles we've heard tell of?
And so along with our EPLs.
And as you spout them off, I'm going to write them on the dry erase here. So we don't, and I'm sure you look confident.
Yes. So, okay. So the 10 obstacles that we, and well, is there an order, a logical order? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is. Okay. So the first one is topography.
Topo, as we call it, right?
Yep. Also known as topo for the course raiders.
Do you want to explain them as we go, or do you want to circle back? Do you want to get all the 10 out and then kind of go back and
I can explain them as we go.
Okay.
So topo, short for topography, is kind of the lie stance of the golfer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, is the ball above your feet, below your feet? Is there a distance? Is there an altitude change between where your ball lies in the fairway to get to the green? And if so, how much? And how awkward is this, your shot into the green?
Okay.
So it's up to the course raider, whomever had or is in charge of that landing zone, to determine how awkward the lie is, and then determine what the altitude change is from where they are in the fairway to the green, because that tells us what row we use and what number to assign to that value, which we can get into here after we.
So it's not. So it's two parts. It's not correct. Just the stance. It's also the. The relative
altitude change.
That's interesting because I think about it's fun because I think about Glenmore Country Club. Man, there's not a level lie on that golf course. You're constantly, and of course, you know, Bear Dance, and it makes it infinitely harder. Common Ground, you've got level lies most of the day, unless you catch a hanging lie off of a bunker or something. You hit in a fairway, you're going to be on a flat lie.
Correct.
That makes the game, and you don't have a whole lot of elevation change.
Correct.
So that's topo.
Topo. And then our next one would be fairway.
Okay.
And fairway is just simply how wide is the fairway at the beginning of the landing zone where your golf ball hits the earth to the end of the landing zone where your golf ball ends.
Okay.
Yeah. Super, super simple. You take the average, and there's a couple different circumstances where you wouldn't take the average, but that's essentially what fairway is.
Okay. And I should have covered this first. So when you're rating these obstacles, what numeric value are you assigning? What's the scale?
So everything is measured. And depending on that measured, it is given a value.
Okay.
So essentially the harder the obstacle, the higher the value it's given.
And how high can that go?
It's rated from 0, which means non-existent, to 10, meaning the highest value you can get.
Okay. And this is in the weeds a little bit, but because I was the John Dukes used to dictate to me the form ones, and I'd sit there and input them into the computer, and he'd say, all right, hole one, fairway, 3-1, which meant 3 for scratch, bump at 1 for bogey.
Yeah.
Is that no longer the case?
Longer the case because that was doing a whole lot. Now it's just 3 for scratch, 4 for bogey.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we got fairway.
Okay.
What's after fairway?
Fairway. Then you have green target.
Are these sort of in sequence with playing the hole? Kind of?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Yes and no.
So green target, that's the approach to the green.
Correct. So again, based on our form ones, which is where what houses all of our data, along with the measurement of the hole, it gives us our mathematical approach shot lengths based on, again, the altitude of the golfer or the altitude and how far the golfer hits the shot. So every hole tells us how far out we should be. Unless, you know, that changes based off a role or any of those.
So a great example, again, I'm picking golf courses, not maybe all of our listeners are familiar with, or maybe not have played, but they may be familiar with number 9 at Castle Pines Golf Club.
Yes.
The green target there is extremely difficult because it's first of all, there's all kinds of, it's well protected. There's a bunker that guards the front. You can't see any of the green surface. You're straight uphill. It's a shallow green. All that's going to roll up into a high green target value. Is that fair?
Well, when you have bunkers are its own thing.
Okay.
So green target is simply how far out you are from the green. The further away you are to, say, depending on how big your green is, if you're far out to a big green, you're going to have a smaller number. Mm-hmm. But if you're very far out coming into a smaller green, your number is going to be pretty high.
Yeah. Okay.
So based on that, you could get a pretty high number. Okay. Or if you have a chip shot in, you have a pretty low number.
So I blended the two. So topo would be more of the, when I talked about nine at Castle Pines, that correct. That would maybe so show that, more in the topo.
That'd be a little
number.
Bit of topo. And yeah. then depending on how far away you are, you might get a little bit of visibility,
okay.
which is a modifier. Because along with these obstacles, each obstacle has a whole alphabet of modifiers right. that you can add.
Right.
Visibility. Can you see it? Can you see the entire flag stick? Can right. you see none of the flag stick?
Right.
So, you know, we might be out there, you know, looking crazy, measuring everything, but everything that we measure is,
you know, I just
purpose.
Thought of this. It almost seems like, and I'm sure I'm not the first to make this comparison, is almost paint by numbers, literally.
Yeah.
You know, you have numbers, and that's the thing I think a lot of people don't understand is course rating is not guesswork. It's not subjective. It's about
right.
taking the data, the numbers. And I know there's always maybe a well-skilled paint by numbers rater is going to remember everything and make sure they don't miss one of those adjustments. But it really, if you can just follow the table, you know, it's, I'm not saying it's easy, but it definitely
correct.
Has a lot of fail safes
correct.
Built into it.
Correct. Yeah. It tries to be as numerically based as possible.
Yeah.
Everything has a number.
Yeah.
And anything that, you know, has to have a little bit of insight from the whomever's rating that tee set, there's a logical,
right.
you know.
Okay, process. We're up to number four. We have fairway.
Okay.
I'm sorry, topo, fairway, green target. What's
number
next?
Number four is rough and recoverability.
R&R.
R&R.
Yeah.
And so that is a bit of a catch-all. So if there's mounding along the fairway, mounding on the green, inconsistency, or for those courses where you see you have a green, and then next to the green you have kind of these almost cut to green height, kind of shoulder areas, there's an adjustment for that. That again, I don't remember everything.
But there's also, but there's, I mean, just at the most basic level, it's like you need to know for the superintendent how where do they maintain their rough?
Correct. That is,
and where do they maintain their native? I know native grasses can vary depending on, you know, how much rain we've received or whatever.
Correct. Correct.
And if somebody hits an errant tee shot, how do you decide? I mean, do you ask a question like, what is the likelihood of recovery, or how do you determine that?
Well, so you're kind of jumping ahead of us.
Oh, okay.
But so we'll save that for
okay.
the obstacle. But for okay. R&R too, you kind of alluded to it. One of our questions that we do ask the golf course prior to us stepping foot on property is what do they set their mowers to? How high their rough is, not their native area, but how high the rough is, and how frequently do they cut it?
So, and this is what this we're just getting into. I mean, we're deep into this, and that's why it's going to be more than one part, because there's so much nuance to it. It's such a sophisticated system. You mentioned like shoulders and more tightly mown. If you're in a golf course that has a lot of those mow outs and that tight grass
mm-hmm.
versus the fluffy, easier for a less skilled player. I mean, for a higher handicap, there's nothing worse than hitting off of a tight lie around a green.
Right.
Even for a good player, they'd rather hit off of a bunker than to hit off that tight lie.
Correct.
So as we look at R&R, and maybe I'm derailing the conversation.
Yeah, well, we were actually talking about this earlier. So a golf course in town actually started doing this, creating those kind of tight lies. They raised yeah. the greens a little bit, creating these little tight lies. And then a lot of people are like, well, I can still putt off of those.
Yeah.
Like why?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can still putt off of those, but now you have to putt on to, you know, not necessarily you're putting from flat surface to flat surface, you're
right.
putting up a hill
yeah.
to potentially, depending
yeah,
on how big the green.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So it actually makes that, you know, the R&R higher when you yeah. have that obstacle there.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I've heard of when I think R&R, I think of rough, but it's
correct.
Also recoverability. So
correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Number five
would be bunkers.
Okay.
And bunkers speak for themselves.
Yeah.
if you've ever seen a course rating team, we go into most bunkers around the greens because we have to determine how much of the green is closely bordered.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be a rater, you have to know the difference between near and closely bordering.
Okay.
One is 10, one is 20. If you want to be a rater, I will tell you the difference between the two. I won't tell you that today.
Well, for example,
yes.
10 at Common Ground.
Tana Common Ground. Yes.
You know how those bunkers are set a fairways back?
Correct.
Is that
so those,
akin to what we're talking about here?
Those would not be considered greenside bunkers.
Yeah.
That would actually be considered fairway bunker.
Yeah.
Which doesn't come into play for everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been in either one of those bunkers.
Yeah, I have. I'm not proud of it.
Yeah.
You know.
It's not an easy shot.
anyway, yeah. So bunkers, we always measure the depth. We measure how much of the green is closely bordered by a bunker. Sometimes, you know, depending on how extreme the bunkers are, we might not even have the option to go to the bunkers, especially if we have a bunker complex. So we might throw what we call an extreme on it. So bunkers can get pretty hairy. And pretty difficult, especially for the bogey golfer, because bogey golfers tend to not play as well as scratch golfers, particularly out of the bunkers. So we always have to get a little more in depth than we need to sometimes. But we, like I said, we try to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, I was going to go exactly there, because we all know, watching the elite golfers on TV.
Correct.
I mean, they love to be in bunkers because they know they're going to hit it to a foot. It sort of follows same, not maybe to the same extent, with a scratch versus a bogey player. So do you find that when you rate for bunkers that you'll see a 2 for a scratch and a 6 for a bogey?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. We see that all the time.
Yeah.
So we see the numbers being super low for scratch, but really high for bogey.
Yeah.
And it's just unfortunate for that bogey player.
Yeah, well, that's accurate. It's the truth. We've all seen that with our eye test.
Correct.
As they scull it over the green and leave it in there. Okay, number six.
Six is crossing obstacles.
Okay.
And anything you have to cross is essentially in this, whether it be water, out of bounds, native grasses, things like that. And this is particularly where we are seeing a lot of the bogey players struggling, because the further the cross, there's even some crossings at some golf courses on some further back tee boxes to where the bogey golfer can't theoretically play the hole because the crossing is too large. Yeah. But in order to get a rating, technically for rating purposes, the
scratch, I think of and 17 golfer, at Cherry Hills with all those cross bunkers on that. Yeah, one. And well, they know they've taken some out. But
Well, even number 2 at Rain Dance.
Yeah.
Bogey can't make it at all. Scratch barely makes it.
Yeah.
Based off of the numerical value.
So that's all crossing obstacles, not necessarily.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's crossing off tee boxes and crossing to get to a landing zone or crossing to get to the green.
Okay. All right.
Seven is laterals.
Okay. So those are the obstacles that run.
Lateral obstacles. Sorry.
Yeah. Lateral obstacles. Okay.
And then again, it's the same sort of deal where you have your native grasses, your out of bounds, your water, stuff like that. Everything is kind of encompassed in there.
Okay. Yeah. And so I'm maybe jumping ahead. So you don't rate for water.
No. Water is no longer has its own category.
Okay.
Correct. So,
got it.
So water can either be a crossing obstacle or a lateral obstacle, depending on its location.
Okay.
And so lateral, though, is where we get to back to your point of playability, because lateral obstacles, particularly native grasses, are twofold. Mm-hmm. The first fold is, can you find your ball? Mm-hmm. The second ball is, can you play it?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where a lot of our time is spent. So you will see us dropping balls in lateral in native rough, in trees, and things like that, to determine, well, one, if we gently toss our ball, will it disappear? Can we find it? And if we can't find it, can we get a wedge, or can we advance it to where we're trying to get it to go? And this also comes into play when we're talking about mid-season conditions, because laterals is kind of a big obstacle, because that tends to change based on the conditions we've had that year.
Yeah, a lot of rain,
a lot of lost balls. If we have a dry season, you're able to find and play golf balls that you wouldn't normally do. So it's up to us as raters to kind of take the average of those two conditions.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to come back to a question, but I want you to be thinking about it. If I asked you, and you're not going to answer it now, I don't ever want to look for a golf ball.
Okay.
I just don't want to look for a golf ball. What golf course in Colorado should I play? Okay. You don't have to answer that now, because I hate looking for golf balls. All right. Number 8.
Okay. 8 would be trees.
Okay. Pretty straightforward. We know what those are.
And trees is the only obstacle where you determine difficulty of play and the ability to recover from the scratch golfer.
Okay.
Fun fact.
So what, the bogey is just assumed that they can't recover, or?
No. So the bogey golfer, you judge the playability or the recoverability.
Oh, same
based
as
off
scratch.
The scratch.
Okay.
Yes.
Why is that?
So bogey golfers, depending on the rater, they could potentially give a an astronomically high value for trees that are easy to play out of for scratch, but not so easy.
I think
for
about
bogey.
Club pro guy, strokes yes. gain, punching out, or whatever yes. it is.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Nine is green surface. Nine is probably a lot of people would say the easiest, but depending on the team, could take the longest because there's only three options: flat, moderate, or severe.
Yeah.
Flat
and speed.
Yes.
So
yes.
You'll stimp the greens.
We'll stimp the greens. And then we have what is known as 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1.
Yeah.
If the golf ball rolls twice as far down as it does up, then it's known as a 2-to-1 or a moderate green. And then if it rolls three times as far down as it does up, then that is known as a severe green.
Okay.
And then we also have tier adjustments that we can throw in there, which brings tears to some golfers' eyes. But, you know, it's all part of the course rating process.
Okay, I'm writing another one for the parking lot. I want to play the most severe greens in the state. Which course would you send me to? Maybe you can answer that one right off the top of your head. You have one.
Ooh, there's a couple. Hiwan.
Yeah.
Hiwan is one. Yeah. I would say if you had the fortune to do a Ballyneal is another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if there's a straight putt on the golf course.
All right. Drum roll for number 10. So we got topo. We have fairway, green target, rough and recoverability, bunkers, crossing obstacles, lateral obstacles, trees, green surface, and last but not least
is actually an obstacle that we don't measure.
Oh, I know what this is. Psychology.
This is psychology.
I remember that. Yeah.
Correct.
And so, that I'm going to answer this and you correct me because I'm trying to show off. That is a byproduct of all the above.
Correct.
Because it used to be when they first introduced psychology, because I remember John Dukes would say, let's just throw in a whatever for just to kind of get it to a number.
Yeah.
It's like, no, we have to, the cumulative effect of all those obstacles lead to a automatic fill them. It kind of, the algorithm spits out a psychology.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And so in order to get that psych number, because they're, if you wanted to, you can actually calculate the psych for every hole for each golfer. But the way the psych is calculated is it essentially adds up all obstacles that equate to 5 or greater.
Okay.
And so depending on the amount of those you have for each hole, for each golfer, that would determine the psych for that hole.
Okay. All right. I am the time. We're going to complete this part of the conversation. So we don't leave our listeners too frustrated. No, this is all really important, right?
Yes.
So let's really fast forward now. We're on 18 and it's getting dark. Okay. So we need to hustle on this one.
Correct.
All right. We got all that information. We got to crystallize that. Explain how that becomes a course rating.
Correct.
Explain how that becomes a slope rating.
Okay.
You're going to have to give the cliff notes on this part.
Perfect. Yeah, no problem. So what we do is we take all of those numbers, again, for both golfers that want a rating for each of the tees. So we take the scratch and the bogey numbers for each hole for each nine, and we put it into a system. And each of those obstacles is given a weighting. And that system essentially looks at the numbers, multiplies it with the rate, with the weighting, adds all of its math, which we won't get into today, and spits out a rating, a front nine rating, back nine rating, and an overall 18-hole course rating, bogey rating, and therefore a slope rating.
Okay. So explain those terms, scratch rating, bogey rating, slope.
Correct. And so the reason why we rate for two golfers is, again, I kind of alluded to it a little bit earlier, but we don't measure or we don't calculate slope when we're out on the golf course. We rate for two different golfers, the scratch golfer and the bogey golfer. And the difference between the two is slope. So when you have an easy golf course for the scratch golfer, but a really hard golf course for the bogey golfer, you're going to have a higher slope. When you have an easy golf course for both golfers, your slope is going to be lower. And then again, also too, kind of, I mentioned it way back at the beginning of this podcast, is that every course is essentially given. And for us, a course is a tee set, and each tee set is its own course. Is given a length rating, which establishes essentially a baseline rating. And then the obstacles are added to that. And the obstacles are either, you know, can either affect it going up or down. So that's what gives you your course rating and your bogey rating. And then again, the difference between the two gives you your slope.
So I can think about all the millions of questions our listeners are going to have. I'm sure you're going to get overwhelmed with comments and questions because of the, I'm sure everybody's riveted. No, it is. It's fascinating. It really is. If you love golf, and you're curious how this is done, I think this has been an amazing first episode of this chat. So a couple things that I would think a listener might wonder, which one of the ratings actually tells me how hard the golf course is? I'm sure you get that question.
Correct.
Is it really the slope rating? Is it the course rating? And how do you answer that question?
I would say slope does not really tell you the difficulty because, again, it's just a mathematical difference between two golfers. I would say the higher the course rating, the harder the court that tee set is.
Okay. So that's really a better number.
That's a better number.
Don't you think that the average lay person thinks to look at slope and correlate that with difficulty?
Or I don't know. I don't know why that is. Because for me, I tend to look at the yardage. I think
it's because it's a whole number.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That too.
Yeah.
But I tend to.
And there's more variance in it because course rating doesn't vary that much.
Correct.
Whereas slope rating varies a lot. So correct. They think they want to, it provides a better sort of continuum of difficulty, at least if you don't know what those two values mean.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. For me, I would either look at the course rating or the yardage. Because I tend to like to play somewhere between 68 and 7,000.
Yeah.
Anything shorter than that, I tend to have to adjust my game. Anything longer than that, I tend to not have any fun.
Right.
But I tend to stay within 68 to 7,000.
Well, this has been a great chat. We've taken our allotted time. We've covered the history of course rating. We talked about why we have a course rating, how we rate golf courses. So I've learned a lot and I've got a lot more questions. As I said, I'm big curiosity, small brain. I'll forget everything that we talked about.
Perfect.
But just to tease this. So next time we get together, we're going to talk about the golfer's favorite topic, sandbagging, how the system deals with sandbagging or exceptional tournament performance, whatever we want to call it.
Yes.
And then we're going to just talk about some of the things you should know as an average golfer that about your handicap, some of the wives' tales about it. But Aaron, thanks for sitting in on this first chat and any parting shots before we call it a day?
No. Well, if you're listening, make sure to get those scores in, whether it's a 6 or 7. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. We'll talk about that. Maximum score. Right. All those good things when we get into how all your responsibilities as an individual golfer. But
yeah, and I guess the last thing too is if you are interested in being a course rater, and
don't do it.
And like you love math because we have a lot of engineers and fighter pilots and all kinds of people who love math in our committee. But if you are ever interested, please feel free to email me and at least come through the training. And if you don't like it, you don't have to proceed. If you do, perhaps this might be something for you. So more than happy to chat with you if you would like.
Aaron, thanks. We'll do it again next month.
Awesome. Thank you.